Among other things, my teacher, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, was a pioneer in what has come to be known as engaged Buddhism. This is a term that was coined in the mid-60s by a group of Vietnamese Buddhists, the most well-known of whom is Thich Nhat Hanh, who were caught between the very corrupt regime that was backed by the French and then the CIA and the United States military apparatus, and the communist nationalist movement led by Ho Chi Minh and others. There's a group of nonviolent Buddhist activists who, in the middle, tried to find what Buddhism calls a middle way between the violence on both sides. And of course, as we still have happening in the world today, everybody who turns to violence points a finger at somebody else to justify our violence. And so many, such as the Dalai Lama, Pope Francis, going back to Francis of Assisi, Gandhi, and many, many others of many faiths, including Islam, have sought a nonviolent alternative to our all-too-human penchant for defending and attacking what we believe to be ours and what we believe to be wrong. We defend one, we attack the other. And that's a bit in the background of tonight's topic, because these are chosen in advance, and this one was chosen soon after the Paris bombings last year, when I was also helping a French friend put together a piece on a Buddhist perspective on what had happened in Paris, and then the response of the so-called West, which was, they're gonna hit us, let's hit them back even harder. And that's even dominating our current presidential election. So this topic is unfortunately still timely, and it may be age old. And so from time to time, I revisit it in the spirit of Ajahn Buddhadasa, who also was a pioneer in Thailand, especially of what Christians often call interreligious or interfaith dialogue. Buddhists aren't too crazy about interfaith because we don't identify as a faith. It's a particularly Christian notion, if you ask me, or maybe Abrahamic, I'm not sure. Ajahn Buddhadasa preferred interreligious with the understanding that given the enormity of some of the challenges facing us, such as the violence I've been touching on, that humanity may only be able to tackle these huge challenges when the religions of the world get on board, learn to stop bickering, posturing, and pretending who's got the real way, And this is a good point to acknowledge the work of friends like the Theosophical Society, who don't have such chauvinism, which is unfortunately all too common among religious traditions, or even say within Buddhism, there's Theravada chauvinism, Zen chauvinism, Tibetan chauvinism, Mahayana chauvinism, which is rather pathetic if you ask me, especially in a tradition that the core notion of liberation is liberation from egoism, and all that chauvinism and posturing. We've got the one and only way. If we actually studied the Buddha's teaching or the teaching of other great teachers, it would be clear that such attitudes are contradicting what we claim to and claim to follow. Unfortunately, seems to me that's kind of the state of religion even today, when some people use their faith to justify building walls to exclude people and all the other forms of exclusion, intolerance, and so on. So that's some background for tonight's topic, and which hinges on how we understand words like spirituality. So I want to take a moment to encourage you to pause internally and reflect. How do you understand spirituality? How do you understand engagement? In the Buddhist context, such as Vietnam, engagement meant actively involved in the suffering within the world, which in Mahayana Buddhism is represented by the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin in China, who is in some traditions pictured with 1,000 arms. And the Sanskrit name of Avalokiteshvara means something like one who hears the cries of the world. And then all those arms are to respond to the cries of the world. Yet over the centuries of Buddhist history, many Buddhists have preferred to isolate themselves in monasteries or in some other way. And rather than being engaged with the suffering of the world, take what appears to me a more passive stance. And so tonight will partly be a challenge to some notions of spirituality, and yet also to engagement. Often our thinking bounces between pairs of opposites. For example, spiritual and worldly. Frequently, these are contrasted, which easily leads, following a certain logic, though I would say not wisdom, but a certain logic, if spiritual and worldly are contrasted or even opposites, then to be spiritual would mean rejecting the world, or if we're a secular activist of some kind, certain forms of humanism or socialism or feminism or even science would see themselves as very engaged with understanding the world. And I've met people who are activists, feminists, etc., who then reject spirituality because it seems to be passive. It seems to be self-centered navel-gazing. To me, and this is a critique that's very strong in the earliest strata of the Buddha's teaching, what I've just sketched out briefly are people taking positions, viewing the complexity, richness, and diversity of life from a rather fixed position. To be spiritual is to be like this. And as soon as we take that position, then others who are different have been defined out of spiritual. Because to be spiritual is to do what I'm doing. Maybe we have a slightly flexible view of that, or maybe quite narrow and rigid. But it will always exclude a number of people. And it happens the other way as well, that the attitude, if you're off on a meditation retreat, and this is something that I had to deal with a lot when I lived in Asia and led retreats for activists and some social activists, environmental, human rights, feminist, fisher folk, would catch a lot of flack from their colleagues because their commitment to the poor, to the people, to the cause was obviously weak. Otherwise, why would they be wasting their time sitting around listening to some navel-gazing, bald-headed monks, especially one who comes from the bastion of bloodthirsty capitalism, Chicago. That's where I was born. So I'm trying to get at how, if we're not careful, we define terms. And it's very interesting, in the early Buddhist teachings, the Buddha doesn't define anything. Modern language will say the Buddha defined blah, 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 but if we go back to the texts, there's no such thing. Similes and puns, wordplay, are common. But to try to nail down a word and it means this came much later, at least a few centuries later in Buddhist history. I can't speak for other traditions, but the Buddha did not seem interested in defining things, partly, I think, because if we define, it's already a narrowing, and if we're not careful, we cling to that definition, take a position, create a fixed view. And in the Buddha's analysis, as soon as that's happened, we're in trouble. And inevitably, quarrels, disputes, arguments, name-calling, taking up rods and sticks, throwing clods of dirt, and doing combat with swords of the tongue. Not exact quotes, but pretty close there. Follows when we take up fixed positions. So I ask you to think about how you understand words like spiritual and worldly. Because the second part of tonight's title, Can We Save Ourselves Without Saving the World, is meant playfully. To me, saving the world is highly problematic, depending what you mean by the world. And I'll reflect on that a bit later. So in the situation that I've sketched, and it's a bit crude, I apologize for that, but time is short. But roughly, if certain notions of spiritual oppose themselves to worldly and vice versa, we have certain scientists and social thinkers who are fairly rabid atheists and seem to take great pleasure in insulting people with religious beliefs and lifestyles. And it goes both ways. Again, I note that with this kind of stuff, often the foil of one's own opinions and positions is caricatured, where a stereotype or a superficial fault-finding perspective, cherry-picked evidence is used in order to caricature someone who we choose to disagree with or oppose. And unfortunately, this is currently rabid in the presidential campaign. I want to use a certain notion that might begin to bridge the gap, not necessarily in the presidential campaign, but the one between the more secular people and the more spiritual people. And I can't help but put those words in quotes, because I don't think they're necessarily opposites unless we choose to make them such. What's fascinated me for many years as somebody who's both attracted to spirituality and religion and various forms of social involvement and has taught meditation and Buddhism among social activists, and did that not only in Buddhist settings, but with colleagues who were Catholic, Hindu, as well as secular. A meeting ground that might be able to melt the divides is both groups, and by groups I mean those taking a position. It could be nobody here takes such positions, or at least not strongly. But when people are taking such positions, I note that they both claim to care. In Buddhism, loving kindness and compassion are considered cardinal virtues. In Christianity, there's charity and love, and other religious traditions have similar words. And yet, secular humanistic movements, I met, for example, many Marxists in Asia who really dedicated themselves to the well-being of others. In many cases, more than overtly religious people who did their religious thing, but weren't actually out there helping as much as some of the Marxists I've met. I'm not saying all Marxists, some were busy purging people who weren't ideologically pure enough. But I was fortunate enough to meet people who claimed to be Marxist and yet were not doctrinaire. They were doing what they could to help workers who were being exploited in factories, or others were organizing peasant farmers who were being marginalized one way or another, and so on. And similarly, the best of feminism, or even today, movements like Black Lives Matter, if we ignore the caricatures in the mainstream media, which is seldom interested in reality, it's interested in profits mainly. But if we dig deeper and actually get stuff from the horse's mouth, there are people who, without any claimed religious faith, claim to care. And many of them behave and live in ways that seem to me to demonstrate caring. How we express it in a formal religious context, how we express it in a more activist way may vary. But the fact that we care seems to me a place to begin. Because the caring is one of the ways we reach beyond ourselves and open ourselves, our hearts, our minds, to the needs and well-being of others. Personally, I think that's central to spirituality. And I find it sad when people who claim to be religious do the opposite. And the same with movements such as feminism, where I've seen similar narrowing and exclusive behavior sometimes. I'm not saying by the majority of feminists, for example. This inquiry I'm making seems to me to come around to how we understand self and how we understand world. The question posed was, can we save ourselves without saving the world? So what is self and what is world? I'm aware that there's probably piles of philosophical writing on such things. As a student of early Buddhism, I prefer a simple and what seems to me pragmatic approach, that is something I can actually do rather and experience right here today, rather than ideas that are floating around somewhere that I cannot embody or live on a day-to-day basis. Grounded in Buddhism, I would like to suggest that what we speak of as self or ourselves more loosely is simply our subjectivity. We're conscious, sensitive beings. We jostle around in a world. We see stuff, hear, smell, taste, touch, are touched. We think, we have emotions. We're highly sensitive beings with a certain capacity for reason, though we don't exercise it all that much, even those who claim to. That's an opinion, so don't take, I'm not gonna push that one. But what I want to emphasize as self is just this subjectivity here. In Buddhism, core teachings claim that we can never pin it down. And this is expressed by terms like emptiness, which doesn't mean nothingness. It just means no fixed, lasting, definable, pin-downable. I think of butterflies desiccated on the wall with little pins in them. It's my image of what happens when we over-define things. Although we may try to pin ourselves down, we always fail. That seems to have been the core of the Buddha's message, and it increasingly makes sense to me. And yet, here we are alive, experience is happening, and if we allow ourselves, we're sensitive, we feel. It can hurt, but we can also experience beauty, joy, love. Self is just, to me, this subjectivity. And then world is simply where we are, where the subjectivity is. As a student in grade school, I remember seeing those old globes on the teacher's desk. I think we had one in third grade with Mrs. Anderson. Not sure if there was earlier. I don't even know if they still have them. And then later there was that iconic image from, I think, one of the Apollo missions of the planet suspended in dark space. Quite beautiful. And those kind of images can tend to enshrine a certain view of the world as that planet. And yet, none of us actually experience that. We might experience the picture, but that's not a world we actually live in. What we live in is what's going on right here around us. So, again, in a certain kind of pragmatism, we might call it spiritual pragmatism, there is this embodied sensitivity, and I'm not trying to reduce it to neurons and brain cells and stuff like that. And also, the world is the world of living experience. If we take this perspective or something like it, and I'm comfortable saying that this seems to be close to the perspective of the Buddha, then self and world go together. There's no subjectivity, sensitive and alive, without stuff to be sensitive to. And that stuff is simply the world. That's actually what world, how world is used in early Buddhist teachings. But it's often misunderstood because we've abstracted the word world to be the planet Earth. And in some contexts, that's important, like addressing global warming. But this can confuse us where we start talking about a world we don't ever experience. We might have ideas about it. But if we come to what we can actually experience, which to me is where meditation and contemplation operate, because there's no other place for contemplation to work but with this conscious moment. Everything else is imagination or memory, which are not bad things, but they're not actual reality. Reality is just what we've got. So if what I'm saying makes sense to you, it does to me. Self and world aren't two separate things. They're, if you like, different sides of the same stuff. Now, saying this, I'm aware that there's a trend in Buddhism and other religions, sometimes expressed as transcendence, that seeks a kind of existence that's disembodied, otherworldly. Kind of, we're going to check out of this hellhole and be somewhere that we imagine to be really hunky-dory. I remember when I was back in Peace Corps reading in the Whole Earth Review for the first time, the notion that eventually we could download our brains onto silicon and then be able to repair the silicon over and over and live forever. I don't know if that appeals to you. It's never appealed to me. It seems to me another strain of the perspective that seems to me, this place stinks. Let's get out of here. Which some Buddhist teachers point out is aversion. And although in Buddhist teaching, aversion will keep us enmeshed in the mess, nonetheless, that's been justified over and over by a certain strand of Buddhist thought, which happens to be a strand of Buddhist thought that rejects social engagement as polluting, to get mired in the muck of the world. And we hear that today. I'm somewhat sympathetic, but I find it tragic with the buffoonery of some of the presidential candidates. It's become so easy to consider it a big joke, a bunch of dirt, and nice, decent people don't want to have anything to do with it. Which means we cede decision-making over society to the buffoons and the egomaniacs. Now, I'm not saying we should all go out and get involved in electoral politics. I'm not convinced that's where we're going to solve these things. But washing our hands of it seems to me on the spectrum of, this is rotten, let's check out. Let's download ourselves to Silicon. Let's get on the spiritual spaceship and go to a better place. Or let's defer our hopes till after death. The kind of pragmatism that I'm suggesting here is to accept that life is embodied. I don't mean it's only about bodies, but bodies are part of the package, as is what we might call the spiritual or consciousness or whatever words we wish. And further, I'm suggesting that the views that I somewhat caricatured a moment ago, and apologies for the quick and dirty approach I took, the issue is not that the world is a mess or the world stinks or politics is dirty or capitalism is greedy and corrupt or socialism is controlling and violent or yada yada. In Buddhist pragmatism, the issue is suffering, distress. The key term in Indian thought and spirituality, dukkha. We experience the world as painful, as distressful, miserable, rotten, what have you, not because the world is that way, not because our bodies are that way. Because if we do that, we're pretending that we're somehow not part of that, which, as I was trying to say earlier, is just not our reality. We do not exist separate from the world, so to condemn the world is to condemn ourselves, and that's if not psychotic, it's messed up. The issue, as Buddhism sees it, is the suffering that's created by clinging. Clinging is holding too tightly to our subjectivity in ways that we try to pin down and fix the me I think I am. We often refer to this as clinging to me and mine. And that arises from being trapped in what Buddhism nowadays we usually translate it as craving. The old Indian word tanha can mean thirst or hunger. And it's not referring to biological thirst and hunger. But when our awareness fixates on something that I've got to have this, or the negative side, I got to get rid of this. When we live through craving, which is a narrow, fixated wanting, I'm not saying the issue is wanting things, but wanting them in a fixated way. That fixation also creates the opposite with our subjectivity, where an open sensitivity gets encapsulated into, say, an identity. And as our psychic energy, the life force is kind of stuck in that, we get egoism, self-centeredness, and often nasty behavior. This perspective, I believe, avoids the two extremes that I've been referring to in various ways. The, what some would say, the spiritual extreme, or others might be the secular or worldly extreme. But if we really care about life, I don't see any value in taking up an extreme. And the word extreme is a translation from a word that roughly is to take a fixed position, as I've mentioned earlier. So what is the response to the craving and clinging that creates suffering? And I should say, before going on, in Buddhism, the notion of caring or compassion is very much a response to the common human experience of suffering. Some Buddhists go too far and say things like life is suffering. You won't find the Buddha actually saying that. You'll see birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. But the context seems to mean that our egoistic clinging to these experiences is the actual distress in suffering. But you'll find Buddhists who turn it into everything is suffering, which to me does not make sense. So what is our response if the core issue is we suffer, people around us suffer, and if we go to legitimate sources of news and information, it seems that there's suffering going on all over the world. And it's not limited to poor or rich or black or white or any of those ways we segregate and dichotomize. So how do we respond? Again, if some wish to respond by what is occasionally called detachment, I'm going to pull back and detach. This used to be actually a common, show up a lot in English translations of Buddhist teachings 30, 40 years ago. Fortunately, one doesn't find it much anymore, because detachment generally means to shut down, to self-medicate, basically to numb oneself by attempting, detaching is to basically reject our sensitivity, which is to reject our capacity to compassion. So it didn't make much sense that we're going to be compassionate by somehow pulling back and withdrawing. And we find that, and I found by some of my missteps in activism, or when I joined the Peace Corps in the 80s, which is what took me to Thailand, by charging in to fix things, jumping in to help in situations where my understanding was poor, to say the least. Youthful, youthful and motivated, but hadn't been around enough to really know what was going on. But that's okay. I had a college degree, University of Illinois, honors student. I knew what to do. And I had a Peace Corps book or something to back me up. Didn't work. Took me a while and some painful experiences to recognize that I was being aggressive. I was pushing my ideas, occasionally the US government's or some other source of ideas on development, without listening to the people I was claiming to help. So on one hand, we detach and we numb ourselves, or on the other hand, we jump in and are kind of pushy, controlling, which boils down to aggressive, and if we're not careful, a little violent. I would say the detaching is violent as well, but it's more an internal violence. To me, that leaves us really with finding what the Buddha calls the middle way. Which, rather than pulling back, closing down, withdrawing, or charging ahead, is actually opening up and being engaged. There's a verse that my wife wanted read, or, well, she read it at our wedding, where the Buddha is asked how to cross a rapidly flowing river. And the response is, by not stopping or standing still, in which case you'll be swept away, and by not hurrying, in which case you'll stumble and be swept away. You keep moving, not too fast, not too slow. This is one of the many similes one finds of the middle way. An expression of this that I think is relevant for tonight's topic is, and this is something I've heard the Dalai Lama, for example, say, we start with our natural inborn self-concern. In Buddhist countries, it's axiomatic that it's natural to love ourselves. Unfortunately, in this culture, it's gotten sort of turned upside down, much to the Dalai Lama's bewilderment. So that's a particular problem in the modern industrialized world, if that's part of the cause of it. But back to places like Tibet or Thailand, at least in the past, it was understood we all care about ourselves. That's just normal. To be alive, one cares about oneself. And Buddhism never saw that as a problem. The problem is when we cling to that and get self-centered and selfish about it. And so Buddhism has advocated taking that natural self-concern, or even call it self-love, and gradually open it up to whoever we come in contact with who may be in distress or suffering. And when we meet somebody who's doing well and happy, we acknowledge it, and the word is mudita, appreciative, sympathetic joy. We can be happy when somebody's doing great. And wish them to continue along those lines. And when they're suffering, our heart opens to it. And if there's a way we can be of service, we endeavor to be of service. This way of thinking is by no means limited to Buddhism. So to wrap up this exploration of engaged spirituality, if the Buddhist perspective of middle way is a valid form of spirituality, and if I've been doing a reasonable job of expressing it, then how can we not save the world as we save ourselves? In Buddhism, salvation or liberation, however we translate it into English, is in terms of saving ourselves from suffering, from the fires of greed, hatred, fear, and delusion, and waking up from the ignorance and egoism that feed those fires. If that's the spiritual path, how we seek our own liberation and peace of mind, how can we not do that in active engagement with the world? And again, I don't see a problem in such words unless we go abstract. If we have an abstract notion of who I am and an abstract notion of the world, then it's possible to separate them. But if we stay grounded in mindful, sensitive, lived experience, self, the world, it's all more or less the same stuff. If there's a difference, there's what's experienced as inside and what's experienced as outside. But try having an outside without an inside, or an inside without an outside. You can't separate the two, even when we try. There's a famous poem from China called the Xinxin Ming, attributed to the third Chan patriarch in China. Chan is the Chinese source of Zen. And this quite beautiful, somewhat long poem ends with, "The way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." And this echoes perspectives that are quite common in early Buddhism. Earlier, I talked about two strong tendencies of preference, which involves making what in early Buddhist teachings are called delineations. We draw lines. Those lines can be rather rigid. They also tend to be abstract. And once we've drawn the line, then we can make choices and have preferences. The way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, which way may mean the way is impossible for those who have preferences. It doesn't say that, so need to be careful about drawing implications. I'll conclude my reflections.
Thank you for this teaching. My question is about the concept of renunciation. And I'm interested to hear you speak about that concept, what it means, and also how that reconciles with engagement with the world.
In Theravada Buddhism, renunciation is often translating a word nekama. And the understanding of that has been dominated by Theravada monasticism. I've also seen it used in Tibetan contexts. I don't know what the Tibetan word or the Sanskrit word underlying it is. I'm going to start with what I've seen in some Tibetan translations, where what is renounced is fixed views, egoism, preferences, liking and disliking, and so on. It's not so much renouncing, as far as I can tell, the world. But it depends, what do we mean by the world? Often, the world is a shorthand term for things like sensual indulgence, or for monastics, sex. Celibate monastics renounce sex. That's believed to make practice easier, though some of us at some point decide that may not be the case. Although we often wait till we're too old. That's another issue. In my own thinking is for the Pali word nekama, I prefer to talk about it in terms of simplicity. Because it's not clear to me that nekama means renounce. That's just what people 100 years ago decided to translate it as. But when I look at context, the idea of giving stuff up is really one of simplifying one's life. I have habits of being a pack rat. And more I'm admitting that those habits, the clutter, complicate my life. Or certain ideas and opinions complicate our lives. And if we've got too much clutter, whether it's stuff, possessions, which means bills to pay, things to clean, things to fix, the amount of time and energy that gets taken up becomes huge. And then there's the mental clutter, emotional clutter, worrying about all kinds of things we don't need to worry about, for example. So if we think in terms of simplicity, is simplifying our lives to free up energy and time for active spiritual inquiry and engagement. To me, that's the context of how the word is used, or the purpose, the benefit. To make it all about getting rid of stuff or not having sex strikes me as materialistic. It's focused on the stuff, when the Buddha was more interested in what's going on in here. And so for me, thinking in terms of simplifying, and it's important for some of us, at least myself, I have a pattern of thought then thinks of the ideal level of simplicity, which is unattainable. So I try to come back to day to day or month by month, taking some steps to simplify areas that I recognize are unnecessarily cluttered.
This engagement requires a lot of energy, a lot of, it's a flow of energy away from you. I presume it's okay then to recuperate and have a certain element of isolation as a result of that flow. So it's not a one or the other.
As one engaged friend liked to put it, to breathe out, you have to breathe in. And also, though, I note when our engagement is grounded and balanced, the energy more recycles. A really balanced, healthy engagement is joyful. When we're authentically, honestly caring, that nurtures us. So I think it's important to inquire into this as well. At the same time, I would agree with you, because it's not like I get it right. So I often overextend or am somewhat out of balance and need to step back, recharge.
Thank you very much, Santi Caro. Following up on this same theme, a way I look at it is the thinking of the airplane spiel they tell you when you're flying, about the oxygen masks. So, you know, if you're traveling with an elderly person or a child, being caretakers, you want to take care of them first. But they tell you what is the opposite. You take care of yourself first. Then you can help other people. So when we get ourselves together, it is in a way, the, you know, we might think of it as being a little selfish or a little detached. But we have to look out for ourselves first before we can be of help or of use to the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Mm-hmm. I agree, as long as that doesn't become a fixed opinion where we get stuck in only taking care of ourselves. Because I've heard arguments like that misused to justify delaying. You know, it may take you 10 seconds to put on your oxygen mask, so you don't have to wait that long to help the person next to you. And while that's a useful simile, sometimes the act of helping someone else helps us as well. So there are different ways to look at engagement. And in early Buddhist teaching, there's a lot of stress on don't do harm to others or ourselves, and do things that are of genuine benefit. If we do something that really benefits ourselves and nobody is harmed, that's cool. Or if it benefits others without harming ourselves, that's cool too. And when we're all benefiting, that's triple cool.
I wonder if there's anything you could say that would clarify for me this idea of the way not being difficult as long as a person has no preferences, because on the surface level, I think you would have to assume that you would rather go home to a warm bed tonight than sleep in the gutter. We all have preferences. It seems impossible to me not to have preferences. So, you know, your remark that maybe he's saying it's impossible to do that, it's paradoxical. I would just like to, if there's anything you can say that would help to clarify that for me, I'd appreciate it.
I'll try. Because yes, I prefer a warm bed. Literally, we heat with a wood stove. And just before coming down here, I was sleeping. We had guests, so I was sleeping at a cabin in the woods. And if the fire went out, I wasn't going to bed in a warm, cozy place. So yeah, I have that preference. I'm not sure, though, that's what the author of the Sensen Min meant. If, like when we're hungry, we have a natural biological need to find food. And Buddhism has always acknowledged basic needs like food, shelter. So a warm, safe bed would I think, be included in that. Access to appropriate medical care. Is that food, shelter, clothing, medicine are the basics. And then some would say spiritual guidance is another basic requisite. So from that perspective, the warm bed doesn't have to be approached as a preference. It's just the basic human need. And we can avail ourselves of those and put some effort into helping as many others as possible have their basic needs met. I think the comment about the way is not difficult for those without preferences. When we actively prefer something, so early Buddhist teachings sometimes talk about liking and disliking. My teacher did quite a bit as well. When we actively prefer or like something, then there's a bunch of stuff, experiences that we don't like. And every time we come across that, we're going to experience distress. and when that which we like is not available. Sometimes you don't have a warm bed or food you like. That causes distress. And the way, as I understand it, the middle way is the way of not suffering. So preferences immediately pulls us off the way.
Someone sent in a question through the internet. What is better, to enter Nibbana or Nirvana, or to renounce Nirvana so that one can dedicate oneself to helping others who are suffering in the world?
My response would be neither. Partly, the idea of renouncing Nibbana historically arose when, due to changes in Buddhist thinking over many centuries, the original notion of Nirvana became you go to some kind of special disembodied realm after death. And one way of rejecting that idea of Nirvana, which I believe is a misunderstanding. By the way, it's weird for me. I'm used to answering somebody, but I'm answering the internet, so I don't know where to look. I'll pick one of you and anyway. So this misunderstanding arose, and then the misunderstanding was rejected by saying, we're going to stay in the world as bodhisattvas. And personally, I think that's an okay resolution, but it's not the one I prefer. The idea of entering Nibbana or Nirvana, I don't know how you enter it. Nirvana is expressed as that reality. It's a little difficult, the words we use for it, because sometimes in translated into English, we smuggle in Greek philosophy. Like, you'll hear words like absolute. Buddhist teachings have absolutely, no sense of absolute. And yet you'll see some Buddhists saying absolute truth, but they're from Burma. They didn't grow up with all the Greek philosophy, so they looked it up in a dictionary and somebody came up with absolute truth. It's more like ultimate truth. Anyway, Nibbana is that reality that is free of birth, free of death, free of being made. See, not made, not born, not dying. How do you enter that? It's not a place. It's not a realm. So to me, the notion of entering Nibbana or not is also a fallacy. The way I understand early Buddhist teachings is Nibbana is the end of greed, hatred, delusion. When greed, hatred, and delusion end, Nibbana is manifest. It's not like it appears, but nothing is obscuring this fundamental reality. Now, often when we think of something like ending, we frame it in time. Like, boy, I'm not going to get rid of greed, hatred, delusion, not in this lifetime at least, maybe 20 or 30, which is, to me, too much thinking. If we would stop thinking and just pay attention, we would notice moments, what my teacher called little nibbanas, or free samples. There are moments in our lives, and some of these moments last a while, where there's no greed, hatred, or delusion. It's not, and the notion of entering often implies somebody or something that enters. But the whole Buddha's path is dropping being somebody. And then there's nobody to enter or not enter. So that's why neither of those choices appeals to me.